about it. I just know what I like. On Tuesday, the engineers on campus staged an event which is too stupid and childish to even mention. It gets enough media attention anyway. What is of concern to me here today is not the event itself, but the peripheral behavior. About 30 women and a handful of men gathered at the scene in a largely spontaneous and certainly peaceful protest. They were carrying posters and a banner which read, "This event degrades people." Now, oh golly, you know the engineers are just a fun-loving bunch of easygoing boys who don't mean to degrade or hurt anybody. The whole thing's just all in good fun. Right. So how come do you suppose they felt the need to pelt these peaceful, smiling protesters with snowballs before the event itself even began? Why did the barrage continue even though the protesters let fly not even one snowball, not even after their banner was ripped in two by the engineers? When the actual procession began, the protesters walked with linked arms, carrying their torn banner ahead of the engineers. The group made no attempt to interfere with the event. Why do you suppose, then, that the engineers felt it necessary to wrestle some women to the ground and verbally and physically abuse them? Why did the protesters finish bruised and spattered by eggs, their banner literally in shreds? Why, if the event is staged all in good fun and is not meant to hurt or degrade anyone, did the engineers premeditate their offensive strategy to the degree that they had eggs on hand to pelt the demonstrators with? Unfortunately, we know the answer to these questions. The engineers' annual event is not all in good fun. It does exploit and degrade women. It is intended to humiliate, to intimidate women, to assert a brotherhood of male dominance. It certainly is not done to make women engineering students feel at home in their chosen program. They have to either reject their sexual identities, their personhood as women, their self-respect, and act like one of the boys, or they can't join the club. When women, and some men, show up at the big event and do not want to join the club, and do have some respect for human dignity, and are offended and hurt by their silly and sensitive game, when they wish to make a peaceful statement to that effect, the whole fantasy, the illusion created by the event for the engineers, is shattered. Instead, they get their rocks off inciting violence against women. They try to make a peaceful demonstration into a violent confrontation. Like little boy poor sports, they launch a childish temper tantrum en masse. But gee, I thought the whole event was just a harmless bit of fun. The hell it is! Tell that to the woman who, not yet recovered from surgery on her nose, got hit with a snowball on that very same nose. Why are the boys in such a frenzy over a little game? Because the business of shoring up insecure and not yet mature notions of masculine sexuality is no game. It's no game to the boys, and it's no game to the millions, and I do mean millions, who have been the casualties of these insecurities, the battered wives, the victims of rape, the victims of sexual harassment and child abuse, even the men who are raped, and certainly the men who are, as a whole sex, diminished by the pimps, the pornographers, the rapists, the abusers, and the engineers. The engineers. They have created this stereotype for themselves. I like to think that the serious students in engineering have neither the time nor the inclination to participate in the inane events of Engineering Week. I like to think that women students in engineering are offended by such events as Tuesday's procession. And most of all, I like to think that for the most part, those who do participate in such events are first-year engineers who naively are led by a few otherwise inconsequential seniors. I like to think those things, but I cannot ignore the silence of these invisible engineers. Their silence indicates acceptance, even complicity. My roommate remarks, "It's Nazi Germany all over again." And my God, she's right. If these mindless jerks do not represent the engineers, then why is no one in engineering denouncing them or moving to have their degrading pranks banned? Let's have more of the sort of prank that really does demonstrate some ingenuity of engineering. You know, like hanging a VW off the Lions Gate Bridge, like Monday's prank of wedging a car wreck in the UBC gates, like building a brick wall somewhere or planting a flag somewhere clever or painting the hut's day glow orange. What is discouraging about the behavior of the engineers on Tuesday is that they behaved exactly according to form. What is frightening is the noticeable lapse in campus security during the event. Yes, there was one car parked at the math building prior to the event. Big deal. The situation obviously was potentially explosive. The engineers had certainly planned to incite violence, evidenced the eggs. Campus security made no presence on foot or on wheels at the head of the procession where the engineers attacked and manhandled peaceful protesters. One is tempted to cite some male brotherhood at work bonding security and engineers. Boys will be boys, after all. But the situation could easily have turned very ugly. Mobs are unpredictable at the best of times. Drunken engineers, whipped into a frenzy, are a particularly troublesome lot. Security should thank the women for their resolve to remain nonviolent. Otherwise, it would have been security with egg on their faces. No, I'm not disappointed or surprised at Tuesday's outcome. The boys lived down to every expectation I had of them. I am no more sick at heart with the state of the sexes than I was on Monday. The only change arising from the event is that another crop of boys has been initiated into the club, having demonstrated the type of arrested development stereotypical of engineering undergraduates across Canada.
Well, 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 ain't it just the truth? The more things change, the more they stay the same. Believe it or not, boys and girls, mums and dad, cats and kittens. That show, that commentary, was broadcast a year ago today, February the 6th, 1985. Okay, so it's not quite a year, but at least it's the same Wednesday, and that was the very first time we put Just Like Women on the air. That was a commentary that Anne wrote on the Engineer's annual Lady Godiva ride. If you weren't there yesterday to see and or hear what they did, stay tuned and listen to Anne and Rochelle's commentary toward the end of the show. That's towards 7:30. You heard at the beginning Angry Young Woman by Mama Kia. Later on, most of Mama Kia, of course, became most of Parachute Club. And that was one of the first songs that we played so many months ago, last year, February 1985. So, this is our first anniversary show. Anne and Rochelle and Elaine and Lil and Bob and Carol and Tet. Oh no, they're not here. We thought that we'd give you some special stuff from our friends and sisters in Ontario, so you'll be hearing in this show from Carol and Patty, as well as from the rest of the gang here.
Don't assume it is passive or easy, this clarity with which I give you yourself. Consider what restraint it takes. Breath withheld, no anger or joy disturbing the surface of the ice. You are suspended in me, beautiful and frozen. I preserve you. In me, you are safe. It is not a trick, either. It is a craft. Mirrors are crafty. You don't like these metaphors. All right. Perhaps I am not a mirror. Perhaps I am a pool. Think about pools.
That was Carol with parts 3 and 5 of Margaret Atwood's very aptly named poem Trick with Mirrors, and the book that that poem is from is called You Are Happy, and guess who it's by? That's right, I can tell you're really up with it. It's written by Margaret Atwood. Soon we'll be hearing from Patty. She'll be giving us an excerpt of Margaret Atwood's Murder in the Dark, which is a fairly recent novel, although not her most recent, because Atwood is a most prolific writer. The song that you heard before Carol reading the poem was Go for Three with The Death of Love. And in case you've been living under a rock these last 12 months, Go for Three is in fact a Vancouver band.
The blurb on the back of Murder in the Dark describes the book as Atwood's 7th work of fiction or her 10th work of poetry, depending on how you slice it. Atwood calls them short fiction and prose poems. We'll start with one called Simmering. It started in the backyards. At first, the men concentrated on heat and smoke, and on dangerous thrusts with long forks. Their wives gave them aprons in railroad stripes with slogans on the front, Hot Stuff, The Boss, to spur them on. Then it began to get all mixed up, with who should do the dishes, and you can't fall back on paper plates forever. And around that time, the wives got tired of making butterscotch brownies and jello salads with grated carrots and baby marshmallows in them and wanted to make money instead. And one thing led to another. The wives said that there were only 24 hours in a day, and the men, who in that century were still priding themselves on their rationality, had to agree that this was so. For a while they worked it out that the men were in charge of a more masculine kinds of food. Roasts, chops, steaks, dead chickens and ducks, gizzards, hearts, anything that had obviously been killed, that had visibly bled. The wives did the other things, the glazed parsnips with prune whip, anything that flowered or fruited or was soft and gooey in the middle. That was all right for about a decade. Everyone praised the men to keep them going, and the wives, sneaking out of the houses in the mornings with their squeaky new briefcases, clutching their bus tickets because the men needed the station wagons to bring home the carcasses, felt they had got away with something. But time is not static, and the men refused to stay put. They could not bear being isolated in their individual kitchens, kitchens into which the wives were allowed less and less frequently because, the men said, they did not sharpen the knives properly, if at all. The men began to acquire kitchen machines, which they would spend the weekends taking apart and oiling. There were a few accidents at first, a few lost fingers and ends of noses, but the men soon got the hang of it and branched out into other areas. Automatic nutmeg graters, electric gadgets for taking the lids off jars. At cocktail parties, they would gather in groups at one end of the room, exchanging private recipes and cooking yarns. Tales of soufflés daringly served at the last minute, pears flambés which had gone out of control and had to be fought to a standstill. Some of those stories had risque phrases in them, such as chicken breasts. Indeed, sexual metaphor was changing. Bowls and forks became prominent, and egg beater, pressure cooker, and turkey baster became words which only the most daring young women, the kind who thought it was a kick to butter their own toast, would venture to pronounce in mixed company. Men who could not cook very well hung about the edges of these groups, afraid to say much, admiring the older and more experienced ones, wishing they could be like them. Soon after that, the men resigned from their jobs in large numbers so they could spend more time in the kitchen. The magazine said it was a modern trend. The wives were all driven off to work, whether they wanted to or not. Someone had to make the money, and of course, they did not want their husband's masculinity to be threatened. A man's status in the community was now displayed by the length of his carving knives, by how many of them he had and how sharp he kept them, and by whether they were plain or ornamented with gold and precious jewels. Exclusive clubs and secret societies sprang up. Men meeting for the first time would now exchange special handshakes, the Bechdel twist, the chocolate mousse double grip, to show that they had been initiated. It was pointed out to the women, who by this time did not go into the kitchens at all, on pain of being thought unfeminine, that chef, after all, means chief, and that mixed masters were common, but no one had ever heard of a mixed mistress. Psychological articles began to appear in the magazines on the origin of women's kitchen envy and how it could be cured. Amputation of the tip of the tongue was recommended and, as you know, became a widespread practice in the more advanced nations. If nature had meant women to cook, it was said, God would have made carving knives round and with holes in them. This is history, but it is not a history familiar to many people. It exists only in the few archival collections that have not yet been destroyed, and in manuscripts like this one, passed from woman to woman, usually at night, copied out by hand or memorized. It is subversive of me even to write these words. I am doing so at the risk of my own personal freedom, because now, after so many centuries of stagnation, there are signs that hope, and therefore change, have once more become possible. The women in their pinstripe suits, exiled to the living rooms, where they dutifully sip glasses of port brought out to them by the men, used to sit uneasily, silently listening to the loud bursts of male and somehow derisive laughter from behind the closed kitchen doors. But they have begun whispering to each other. When they are with those they trust, they tell of a time long ago, lost in the fogs of legend, hinted at in packs of letters found in attic trunks, and in the cryptic frescoes on abandoned temple walls, when women too were allowed to participate in the ritual which now embodies the deepest religious convictions of our society, the transformation of the consecrated flour into the holy bread. At night they dream, long clandestine dreams, confused and obscured by shadows. They dream of plunging their hands into the earth, which is red as blood and soft, which is milky and warm. They dream that the earth gathers itself under their hands, swells, changes its form, flowers into a thousand shapes, for them too, for them once more. They dream of apples. They dream of the creation of the world. They dream of freedom.
Male chauvinist pig engineer.
Women's novels. One. Men's novels are about men. Women's novels are about men too, but from a different point of view. You can have a men's novel with no women in it, except possibly the landlady or the horse, but you can't have a women's novel with no men in it. Sometimes men put women in men's novels, but they leave out some of the parts, the heads, for instance, or the hands. Women's novels leave out parts of the men as well. Sometimes it's the stretch between the belly button and the knees, sometimes it's the sense of humor. It's hard to have a sense of humor in a cloak, in a high wind, on a moor. Women do not usually write novels of the type favored by men, but men are known to write novels of the type favored by women. Some people find this odd. Two. I like to read novels in which the heroine has a costume rustling discreetly over her breasts, or discreet breasts rustling under her costume. In any case, there must be a costume, some breasts, some rustling, and overall discretion. Discretion overall, like a fog, a miasma through which the outlines of things appear only vaguely. A glimpse of pink through the gloom, the sound of breathing, satin slithering to the floor, revealing what? Never mind, I say, never mind. Men favor heroes who are tough and hard. Tough with men, hard with women. Sometimes the hero goes soft on a woman, but this is always a mistake. Women do not favor heroines who are tough and hard. Instead, they have to be tough and soft. This leads to linguistic difficulties. Last time we looked, monosyllables were male, still dominant, but sinking fast, wrapped in the octopoid arms of labial polysyllables, whispering to them with arachnoid grace, "Darling, darling." Four. Men's novels are about how to get power, killing and so on, or winning and so on. So are women's novels, though the method is different. In men's novels, getting the woman or women goes along with getting the power. It's a perk, not a means. In women's novels, you get the power by getting the man. The man is the power. But sex won't do. He has to love you. What do you think all that kneeling's about? Down among the crinolines on the Persian carpet. Or at least say it. When all else is lacking, verbalization can be enough. Love. There, you can stand up now. It didn't kill you, did it? Five. I no longer want to read about anything sad, anything violent, anything disturbing, anything like that. No funerals at the end, though there can be some in the middle. If there must be deaths, let there be resurrections or at least a heaven, so we know where we are. Depression and squalor are for those under 25. They can take it. They even like it. They still have enough time left. But real life is bad for you. Hold it in your hand long enough and you'll get pimples and become feeble-minded. You'll go blind. I want happiness guaranteed, joy all round, covers with nurses on them or brides, intelligent girls but not too intelligent, with regular teeth and pluck and both breasts the same size and no excess facial hair. Someone you can depend on to know where the bandages are and to turn to the hero, that potential rake and killer, into a well-groomed country gentleman with clean fingernails and the right vocabulary. Always, he has to say, forever. I no longer want to read books that don't end with the word forever. I want to be stroked between the eyes, one way only. Some people think a woman's novel is anything without politics in it. This is six, in case I didn't mention that. Some think it's anything about relationships. Some think it's anything with a lot of operations in it, medical ones, I mean. Some think it's anything that doesn't give you a broad, panoramic view of our exciting times. Me, well, I just want something you can leave on the coffee table and not be too worried if the kids get into it. You think that's not a real consideration? You're wrong. Seven. She had the startled eyes of a wild bird. This is the kind of sentence I go mad for. I would like to be able to write such sentences without embarrassment. I would like to be able to read them without embarrassment. If I could only do these two simple things, I feel I would be able to pass my allotted time on this earth like a pearl wrapped in velvet. She had the startled eyes of a wild bird. Ah, but which one? A screech owl, perhaps, or a cockatoo? It does make a difference. We do not need more literalists of the imagination. They cannot read a body like a gazelle's without thinking of intestinal parasites, zoos, and smells. She had a feral gaze like that of an untamed animal, I read. Reluctantly, I put down the book, thumb still inserted at the exciting moment. He's about to crush her in his arms, pressing his hot, devouring, hard, demanding mouth to hers as her breasts squish out the top of her dress, but I can't concentrate. Metaphor leads me by the nose into the maze, and suddenly all Eden lies before me. Porcupines, weasels, warthogs, and skunks, their feral gazes, malicious or bland or stolid or piggy and sly. Agony to see the romantic frisson quivering just out of reach. A dark-winged butterfly stuck to an overripe peach, and not to be able to swallow. Or wallow? Which one? I murmur to the unresponding air. Which one?